This is Ida Sullivan and Judy Rubenstein for the National Council of Jewish Women in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, interviewing Mrs. Catherine Falk on June 19, 1978.
Mrs. Falk, we have a summary of your interview with Carol Elias, and there are a number of places where there are questions, and there are also a number of places where certain material was omitted. So I hope you don't mind if I very, very quickly go over some of the things that were omitted. For example, your father's name.
Sigmund, S-I-E-G-M-U-N-D, B, Sonneborn.
Where was he born?
He was born in a little town called Breidenbach, B-R-E-I-D-E-N-B-A-C-H, which is in Hessen, Germany.
All right. And your mother's name?
My mother's name was Camille Catherine Goldschmidt, G-O-L-D-S-C-H-M-I-D-T.
Okay.
She was born in Washington, D.C.
But her parents had come from Germany?
Her parents came from Prague.
Okay. And the names of your siblings were not on the report from Carol. I don't know if she asked for your siblings' names.
I don't know. My oldest brother is Rudolph G. Sonneborn.
Does he spell it P-H or F?
F.
I've seen it spelled many different ways. And where does he live?
He lives in New York.
Mm-hmm. And
his sister, Amelie Katz, who lives in Baltimore.
Mm-hmm.
And my younger sister, Josephine, has been dead about 12 years.
Yes. All right.
Maybe 15.
Okay. You mentioned life in Baltimore. I was wondering if your family was friendly with the Sold family at all. Did you have any connections with them?
Of course. Yes. The Sold family, the Frieden World family. I've just spent the last couple of months editing the letters that my brother wrote when he went to Palestine as the secretary to Dr. Friedenwald, who was the appointed the Zionist commissioner by Weizmann.
Mm-hmm.
And he was there from the winter of January, actually, of 1919 until July.
Well, what were your encounters with Henrietta Zold? Were there any?
No,
you were too young.
She was long since gone. Had lived in New York for a good many years before she went to Palestine. My parents spent time with her when they were in Palestine in 1934.
We have some prominent Pittsburghers here also. Mrs. Falk, in the interview with Carol Elias, you mentioned your parents' religious upbringing and the religious atmosphere at home. Could you tell us what synagogue they belonged to, which temple they belonged to? Do you remember the name of it? Was it the same one of which Benjamin Sold was the rabbi?
No.
No.
This was the one where William Rosenau was the rabbi.
Oh, well, he's the one who helped Mr. Rabbi Freehoff become a student at Hebrew Union College.
Good.
And he's the one that edited the book on Rabbi Berkowitz, so I know the name. I didn't know him. So it's probably very important Reform temple in Baltimore.
But I can only tell you that by the standards of Pittsburgh Reform, that was conservative. I had never seen a rabbi without a tallit and a yarmulke, and I had never seen a service without a cantor before I got here.
You also mentioned that you went to Park School. Could you tell me if you had any special religious education? In addition to going to Park School, did you also go to any kind of Hebrew school or Sunday school or religious school?
No. We were taught at home by a lady whose name I've long since forgotten, but she was one of Miss Zold's very good friends, who taught in a German-English school in Baltimore and was a marvelous teacher. And we each had an hour alone with her on, I can't remember whether it was Shabbat morning. No, it must have been Sunday morning because we went to synagogue.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, very good. There's a sentence here which I find rather difficult to understand. It may be that Carol mistyped or misunderstood. She talks about you're participating in a jam session. Do you play a musical instrument?
In a jam session.
She says, you entered college in Wellesley, and you remember your first night of your freshman year sitting in a jam session in the dorm.
Maybe you use a different word for it when you sit around talking with the people.
Oh, no, a jam session is when you play jazz.
I say, there may be another
word. Oh, I'm sorry, I thought you played a musical instrument.
That she didn't get the right... Or I didn't get the right
okay,
word.
Then you do not play a musical instrument, and you were not playing jazz at the time. Good, then we have that straight. Now, there's also a mention here, which I didn't quite understand, the Galilean analysis of Faust. I mean, Faust as Jesus, or Faust as... She says, a special emphasis on the Galilean analysis of Faust.
Hegelian.
Oh, my gosh. I couldn't figure Faust as Galileo or... Okay, here, it's very good that we're correcting these because we don't want posterity to have the wrong opinion.
I can't imagine why they should be in there, but go on.
Well, would you give us the names of your children? We don't have it in here.
Oh, well, the oldest child was Liam III, who died when he was... around a year old. The next one was Ellen, then Sarah, S-A-R-A.
Excuse me, Ellen, who is married? Or
who was
what is
married
her name?
To Joseph Glick.
Oh, I see.
Was divorced, is now, is the widow of Wallace Hirsch.
Okay.
Sarah, S-A-R-A, who married Dr. Kenneth Moser.
Mm-hmm.
And Sigo, S-I-G-O,
yes.
Who married Jean Davis.
Yes.
David, who married Judith Rao.
Is that R-A-U-H?
Yes. And Susanna, who married William Shopsin, S-H-O-P-S-I-N. She had a very brief previous marriage. I can't even remember his name.
Judith Rao, is she one of the Pittsburgh Raos or Washington Rao?
Not any. She's Cincinnati Rao.
Okay.
She's the niece of Joseph Rao.
The lawyer.
Yeah, the
lawyer. Okay. Well, they're probably related all the way back, but...
I don't think so.
One of the statements here, we're just reviewing what Carol
Please.
Did, and I'm skipping around. I hope you'll forgive me. There's a statement here. In order to help Leon cover all of the meetings, Kitty sat on none of the boards and reported to Leon. I can't believe this
None of the boards that he sat on.
Okay, I'm glad that's been corrected because it made no sense to me how you could report if you didn't sit on.
There were too many boards for him to sit on,
mm-hmm.
So they were divided up.
Okay, fine. That's great. That clears up a very big question here. We're now going to skip all of the years in between because we want to get to closer to the present. Just one more question. You registered at Brandeis, it says here. This was sometime in the late 50s. And you spent 4 years at Brandeis. Did you get a degree from Brandeis?
Sure.
What?
I got a master's in Judaic studies. And I stayed on to start a doctorate, which I didn't finish because I don't need to have a degree. I can study without that.
Okay, and then we'd like to know when you really made your decision to make Aliyah. It's not quite clear. You went back and forth. You were in Israel, and you hint here that you had thought, but you say here you felt sure that one day you would live in Israel, but this may be Carol's impression.
No, not at all. There were family reasons that I couldn't leave this country. When the time came that there was no longer family reasons, I moved over.
When was this?
I went over in 64, but I had been there. I think the one long interval may have been 3 years or 4 years, I've forgotten, but I'd spend 2 months or 7 months or whatever happened to suit my schedule.
And making Aliyah, how did you go about settling there, what did you do? I mean, what was the first thing you did? Did you buy a house or rent a house or take a... Well, you didn't live in a hotel, did you?
No, I went over to find out if, after all, people like ourselves knew all the government people.
Yes.
I have enough sense not to call Golda and say I'm lonesome this evening. So, I had to find out if you're alone, if I knew enough people or could make enough relationships with acquaintances to have friends.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And I lived in the apartment of one of my cousins who is in the Foreign Service. And when he went off to be ambassador in Senegal, he left his oldest daughter, who was doing her final stage for a law degree.
Would you mention your cousin's name? I'd like to have it on the
His table. Name is Hanan, H-A-N-A-N, Aynor, A-Y-N-O-R.
Is this from
Sonneborn? Which is Sonneborn in Hebrew. Aynor, source of light, which is what Sonneborn means.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
And his oldest daughter is Ayala, now married, with several sons, and the assistant to the Attorney General of the state. She's that good.
So that you did have relatives in Israel, you
oh,
weren't all alone?
All
oh,
over
okay.
the place.
Great.
But not in Jerusalem.
Mm-hmm.
And
what made you decide on Jerusalem?
Mainly because one of the cousins on my mother's side of the family, who was widowed when I first met her in 1950, married a refugee in this country in 1962 or 3, and I no longer had a roof over my head. And I'd always lived in Jerusalem with her whenever I was there.
Mm-hmm.
Very simple.
Could you tell us a little bit about, I visited you in 1970, and so I saw your home, and I'm very interested to have on tape where you found the house, how you found the house, and so on. Because it's become very well known in Pittsburgh, at least, when people go to visit Israel, and they go to Jerusalem, they visit Catherine Falk's house.
They're quite right. The house is the oldest building outside of the walled city. And when I started looking for a place to live, I wanted to be somewhere where I faced the old city walls, even though we couldn't get to it because there was no man's land in between. I asked all kinds of people, including a friend of my cousin who was no longer there, but become a friend of mine by then, who was a builder. And he heard on the street that a contractor wanted to buy that 2-dunam area, tear down the old house, which was in bad shape, and put up an apartment house there. And I had 2 strikes against him. I didn't have to ask city permission to tear down a house I wasn't proposing to tear down. And I had warned my son, Sigo, who looks after me, that he should have a little money in the bank, because $2,000 translated into pounds is a very large amount. And this, with that kind of money, you could bind the initial stages of a contract. So I moved in before the contractor had been able to borrow any money or had any permission from the city to do what he wanted to. And the man that was selling it lived in Haifa and was very glad to be rid of it because his daughter with 3 children under 5 had been deserted by her American husband and was off in a kibbutz. And Papa, who had inherited the house when his wife died and whose name it happened to be, wanted the little bit of money it brought. In those days, living 100 meters from the border, this place went begging because it had been empty for over a year when I took it.
Did you have to do a lot of work to fix it up? Plumbing and so on?
Well, I put bathrooms in. I didn't propose to go out into the communal bake oven of the village of Abu Tor, in which the Britisher who lived in the house had put the toilet. So I had 1 bathroom when I moved in, and the second one about 6 months later.
Do you live there all alone?
Yes.
And you have lived there since 1960?
I moved in 65.
And you felt secure this whole time?
Look, In Israel, you don't ask silly questions like that.
Yeah, but I'm not
in Israel
now. I'm in Pittsburgh.
It doesn't make any difference whether you're 100 meters from the border. When they're shooting, one house gets hit at the border and another one gets hit across town.
Can you tell us some impressions of the 67 war since you were there during that time?
Nobody who hasn't heard of war can believe it, so it's not worthwhile. It's just terribly noisy. And since my hill was between the two places that the Jordanians attacked, we got the most noise.
Have you been involved in various volunteer work in Israel during the period
No,
of your
because I've never
there?
Learned any Hebrew. I speak a language and don't hear it. Mm-hmm. As a consequence, I can ask what I want to, get an answer which I don't understand, and being bilingual, I say, Bevakasha, Anglit uGermanit, and if they can't do English or German, then it's sign language. It means that it cuts me off from all kinds of things I'm quite sure I would enjoy taking part in. But
I cannot envision you just sitting there with your arms folded. Since
I don't. I read.
And entertain Pittsburghers.
I'm a good student. That's fairly useful. It's not only Pittsburghers, because after all, I was one of the founding members of the UJA Women's Division. And having talked all over the country for UJA and later for Bonds, in the early days, this is no longer true, because the leadership group, after all, I'm 73, the leadership group is now in the 50s and 60s. They would be the children of people I know, if I still, and I've been away 14 years. But in the early days, first place, there weren't very many people coming over. In the second place, there were very few people making Aliyah who had the space. There probably weren't 5 or 6 homes in all of Jerusalem before 67 with a room large enough to put 50 people in. And to this day, every organization knows that if they want a meeting at my house, they don't get more than a biscuit and a cup of tea, because I don't believe in fancy business. But
in other words, your home has been a
and
place where groups have met.
And this way, and they still do. But in the early days, some UJA mission from didn't matter where. Mm-hmm. If somebody knew me and called, anybody that had no family or friends in Jerusalem, I'd say bring them along. Doesn't really matter whether it's 10 cups of tea or 6 cups of tea.
I know that the Falk Foundation Jerusalem was founded by your former husband. I wonder if you have any connection at all with that Falk Foundation.
No. I know what they do. But in the early days when I came and went, I used to check in with them because then I'd report when I got back. But since I live there, they no longer need that kind of connection, because the Falk Foundation went into the university. Mm-hmm. And so is no longer dependent on the foundation at all.
You say back and forth. How often do you visit Pittsburgh since you've settled in Israel?
It varies. It depends on family. It averages once a year, but sometimes it's a year and a half. And once it was 8 months, and I got stuck in the dentist chair for 2 months.
Because one of the important questions that we ask all of our respondents is to contrast Pittsburgh today with Pittsburgh yesterday. And I was wondering if you have any impressions.
I would be completely unable, because when I come, my son lives in Thornburg, and I always spend 3 or 4 days with him and his family, with no transportation to the city that's public, not liking to take anybody's time. I may come in with my son in the morning and do something and get back out. But when I'm in the city, the few people that I've known for the last 50 years I see, but that's it. Because when you've been away as long as I have, the connections really get very loose.
Can you give us some of your impressions of political life in Israel since you've lived there more than 10 years? Do you have any involvement at all politically?
If you'll turn your tape off, I'll tell you something.
When asked about the political life in Israel. You started telling, comparing.
But I asked you whether you knew any Europeans who came to this country in the 30s as refugees. And you said yes. And I asked you also whether you felt that any of them really understood the American system. And you shook your head and said sort of, well, really not. And you expect me, in a few words, to tell you of a system that is totally different than the American one. There's nothing in the system here that I can ground what I would like to tell you. And so what I would say would have very little real meaning for you. It's much closer to the French kind of system. Anytime there's an ideological party and somebody decides to leave the dot off an I, they have to start a new party.
Are you an Israeli now? Have you taken Israeli citizenship?
This was one of the errors I made. When I went in to become a permanent resident, I answered a question which I should not have answered, but I never asked a lawyer beforehand about this. I just went in and did. And a couple of years later, the Israeli government gave people like myself a chance to write them a letter and ask to have that eliminated. And I got a letter from the American embassy saying that if I did it, it would be held against me. I have too much family here. A brother who's about to be 80 and has always been 7 years older, and a sister who's older, and children and grandchildren. And I cannot put between myself and an emergency the fact that it's Sunday and the consulate isn't open, or the guy's gone away for a trip and won't be back for 3 days, or any of these other. So I am a citizen to the, I'm not a citizen. I am a permanent resident. I can vote for the mayor mm-hmm. of the city in which I live and for the president of the United States mm-hmm. because the American law just changed to allow people outside of the country. I don't vote in party elections.
But you can vote for the mayor of Jerusalem. I didn't know that.
Right.
That's very
yes.
interesting.
Well, that's always been.
Would you mind if we asked what that was? Or
what mayor?
What the question, no, what the question. The question that you answered.
I don't agree, for heaven's sake. That was 12 years ago.
But having lived in Israel, I know that.
I have no idea. It was. It had something to do with something that the United States would consider an allegiance or something. I don't know.
Yeah, because now people can have dual allegiance.
Everybody can
it's
have.
It's been challenged in the courts, but
that's
at
right.
that time it wasn't possible.
But at that time you simply didn't answer the question. And by you automatically got your passport. And I presume I was too. I just presumed you answered whatever you were asked.
You talked to Carol about your early interest in Zionism, your deep feeling about Zionism. Has living in the State of Israel been a fulfillment of those dreams? Are there any disappointments?
My field is Jewish history. We've gone 1,900 years without a state of our own. And we've suddenly, by all kinds of accidents, I don't even know what, time and space and war and Holocaust and all the other things, managed to get a state of our own. How anybody stays out of it, I don't understand. Because this is our chance, finally, to show ourselves, even ourselves, what we are. Not to mention the world. The world, of course, uses a double standard on us, expects us to be perfect in it. There are 300 conferences, roughly, international ones a year in Israel, and each profession thinks that we ought to be a textbook perfection, which is a great compliment and absolutely asinine. In 30 years, we're supposed to do that. I can tell you that everything that can be wrong in any country in the world is wrong in Israel. And every dirty trick that any Jew ever played anywhere, I can find you at least 5 examples without looking very hard. And still, if we can't cope with these things ourselves and eventually build up a Judaic civilization. It's too bad. It's because the people who have the energy and the will and the opportunities there, the fact that it's easier to stay in the United States, no question about it. It's a very hard place to live.
May I ask your opinion on the Noshrim, on the people who emigrate from the Soviet Union as coming into Israel but do not and instead go to the United States?
No, you can't ask me that because it's an unfair thing to ask of them. They haven't had any Judaic education for 50 years. They know absolutely nothing. This is their chance of getting out of an oppressive society where they are considered a nation, which is why the word Jew is in their passport, and are given none of the pluses that being a Jew is, and all the minuses. And their one chance of escaping this is to say they want to go to Israel. So that I can tell you something that you may or may not know. Under some fund at Harvard University, a study has been made of the immigration to the United States, and I think Nobel Prize winner, a man named Kuznets, was asked to do the migration from 1880 till the laws went through in 22 that stopped immigration. Except for the Jews who had no place to return, 90% of all the people who migrated to the United States in that period up to World War I went back to the place they came from. And everybody's screaming about 300,000 Jews who have left Israel in a period of 30 years out of 3 million people. It's nothing. It's a drop in the bucket. And a very large percentage of those are students who come over here and they're called, who study. They may even work here for a couple of years. If you've lived in this society for a while and see the incredible wastefulness, luxury, and all the other, my first days here are always the same. I look at these beautiful shop windows and think all the creative capacity that went into doing this. And after the third day, I want to spit. Sorry. Ladies who were brought up in Victorian households like me, spitting is the absolutely not allowed. And so that's the strongest
thing you could say.
That's
yes.
Right.
I'd like to ask you about religious affiliation. Do you have any in Israel? I know, of course, that the official religion is Orthodoxy.
The older I get, the more observant I get. I've kept kashrut at a level that anyone who is strictly observant and will take nothing in anybody's house except their own, who needs the glatt kasher thing on a plane. I take kasher on a plane because it's much nicer. But who on El Al will not eat the kasher food but have to have glatt. They can't eat in my house and won't. But anybody who will eat in a restaurant or in a hotel can eat in my house. I do not mix meat. I will put it on the table for people who don't care. So they get their meat here and their cheese there, and that isn't comme-il faut, that I know. But I use the kind of plates that
I didn't really mean that. I wasn't going to investigate your kitchen. I meant more in terms of participation in services, belonging to any kind of synagogue and that kind of thing. If you're
generally speaking, this is, I happen to go to the Hebrew Union College Chapel because my daughter worked there for the last couple of years. And I was a friend of Nelson Glick's. And he happened to ask me before the High Holy Days if I had tickets, which I had forgotten to get because I'd been in America. And so he gave me tickets, and the next year when my family came over, I don't divide families. And since I don't go to synagogue with any regularity, I might as well go with them, where they go. And they leave at 12 o'clock on Yom Kippur, and I don't leave, except when a war starts.
Well.
And then I left only after the second alert, because I needed to find out what had happened to the family.
Have you been active in trying to forward the reform movement in Israel?
No, quite the contrary. The older I get, look, I'm a good historian.
Mm-hmm.
People say that if Israel destroys, the Jews will be destroyed. That isn't true. An Orthodox Jew will not be destroyed. We've had crises like this before. In fact, I think the good Lord has been extra good to us to give us a breather like the state of Israel. And when the oil crunch gets so that the United States wipes us off the map, it's not going to be the end of Judaism. The fact that we had the strength after 6 million were killed and 12 million were left, and the handful of that 12 million had enough strength to bring Israel into being, I'm not worried. But the only people who have, with minor exceptions, who have the discipline to take the negatives of Jewish life are the people who are disciplined by halakha. That halakha needs to be brought up to date exactly as the Roman Church, when the Reformation took place,